Literally, I think in the 10 minutes we've been waiting to record this podcast, Nate has ruined the credibility of 538. Galen, don't release any of this.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. We've got another big day of primaries this Tuesday that will test just how competitive the race between Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden still is. The states weighing in are Michigan, Washington, Missouri, Mississippi, Idaho, and North Dakota. We're also going to look at why Americans of different political stripes are viewing the threat of the new coronavirus differently, and we'll discuss what the repercussions of the outbreak could be for the primary and even the general. And here with me to do all of that, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. How's it going?
The general what?
Oh, election. My God, election.
I know. I'm sorry. How are you?
Nate is punchy today.
Also here with us is senior politics writer Claire Malone. How are you?
I'm good.
And managing editor Micah Cohen. How are you?
Very good.
I'll tell you what makes you punchy. Is waking up at 7 a.m. being like, actually, I don't have an early schedule today. I can sleep in. And then having crippling anxiety about coronavirus.
You are really anxious market. About this, huh?
I was fucking into coronavirus before it was cool. I was nervous about it for several weeks.
True, Nate,
and I'm not the type. I'm not the type who's usually actually neurotic about that stuff.
But you are nervous.
You're not the anxious type?
Usually not, which is why coronavirus, you know.
Yeah.
I've been reading about it kind of all weekend, but I just got up and had my coffee as usual, wrote the script for this podcast.
It has definitely altered my behavior. I'm washing my hands more. I didn't touch anything on the subway. It's something.
Well, we're going to get into exactly that right now. So let's begin with one of our favorite questions, good use of polling or bad use of polling. And today's example comes from Reuters and relates to the coronavirus. A Reuters article based on a poll they conducted last week reads, quote, Americans who now find themselves politically divided over seemingly everything are forming two very different views of another major issue, the dangers of the new coronavirus. Democrats are about twice as likely as Republicans to say the coronavirus poses an imminent threat to the United States, end quote. And they go on to detail how Democrats and Republicans are preparing differently, like who's washing their hands or, you know, so on. The analysis in this article mostly emphasizes the difference in media consumption between the two partisan camps. So, Micah, is that a good use of polling or a bad use of polling?
I think it's like half a good use, half a bad use. I'm sure there probably is an effect in terms of partisan views, this is a crisis happening while Republican is in the White House. And therefore, given today's polarized times, I think you would expect some effect where Republicans are more likely to downplay the crisis. Democrats are more likely to play up the crisis, right? But I also think some of the numbers you see here are driven not by that, not by partisans taking a partisan stance on an issue, but just by the different geographic, demographic makeups of the party, where Democrats are more likely to be in cities, Republicans are more likely to live in rural areas. And so you'd expect to see some difference there in how scared people are about that.
I agree with that. Chadwick Matten and I were having breakfast before I taped this podcast.
He's our editor.
He's our editor.
For people who don't know Chad.
Shout out Chad. Extremely smart. But he was talking about this. He was like, we all live in New York. New York is basically just, you know, socially, news coverage wise, filled with coronavirus talk.
Yeah.
We all ride the subway every day. We're always within 6 feet of people. And so it's like so the news media is clustered in New York and DC, but also these cases are in Washington State and California and New York. It's a blue state problem right now. And I think that that's kind of, you know, it could change. Who knows what we don't know how the virus will spread or if it will reach all 50 states. My inclination is it probably will, but I'm not an epidemiologist, as everyone listening to this podcast probably knows.
You know what, though? You don't have to be because you can read Twitter.
For
the kids listening to this podcast, the precocious little mother who are listening to this, do not listen to Nate Silver. Listen to the experts on diseases. But I basically think that right now, this is kind of like a geographically skewed thing. And it almost reminds me of, remember Trump's disaster relief response to like the California fires versus the hurricanes in Florida, right? Or in Texas.
Or in Puerto Rico.
Like the way that response was also partisan.
Yeah.
I can't help thinking, Could coronavirus be partisan that particular way?
That's already happened. You actually saw a town in Alabama say, no, we don't want any of the people who are quarantined from the cruise ship in Alabama. And Trump was like, okay, fine. And then assigned them to California. And then California sued and said this is political favoritism. Or the town in California sued and said this is political favoritism. But the Reuters article that analyzes this poll focuses a lot on media consumption. And so we've mentioned geographic differences. So just the difference in what they're saying on Fox News versus what they're saying on, you know, the networks or other cable news networks could make up this difference. What do you say to that, Nate?
I mean, I'm reading the Fox News website now, and it has quite a few headlines about coronavirus. Also a picture of Hillary looking not at her best.
Jesus.
Hunter Biden. Headlines. Joe's bro, whoa.
Welcome to the 538 podcast where we just read you the Fox News headlines.
Look, I think infectious disease is something which understandably triggers people's anxieties. And I think it's not the kind of thing that you can suppress concerns about for all that long. And I think it's also the kind of thing that independently of that is a very dramatic news story, especially in the way that tends to have after effects like on markets and stuff like that. And so, I mean, that writer's poll might be a perfectly good snapshot of kind of what was going on at the time. You know, I take Micah's point that like it is more concentrated, Claire's point that there is more concentration of blue states so far. But I don't know. I'm not sure that like...
Who knows for how long that will hold.
It's also more of a risk factor for people who are older,
yes.
Which we also know would mean that it skews towards Republican voters simply because they are older.
Yeah. I mean, we also haven't talked about Trump himself has been not sticking to the talking points that the CDC would like him to stick to. He's erroneously asserted that, oh, it's going to for sure, the virus will for sure disappear when it gets warmer. There's going to be a vaccine. Those things might be true, but we don't know them yet. That's not what public health officials are telling people.
He also said, if you want to get tested, you can get tested, which caused a bunch of people to try to get tested, and they couldn't.
Which is very much not true. In fact, there is a huge shortage of testing kits in the United States, which is actually a big problem for, say, a state like New York. The Atlantic had a very good piece about it, which I would urge people to read by Robinson Meyer and Alexis Madrigal about basically the lack of testing in the United States compared to other countries that have had this outbreak. So we don't even have a good baseline number for how many cases there are. But if you're a Republican who watches Fox News and Fox News is heavily covering Trump's trip to the CDC, perhaps without the same sort of critical eye that other news outlets would have when covering those remarks, you might have a different understanding of the risks of coronavirus. And again, there are a lot of question marks. It could end up being the death rate of the flu or a very bad flu. It could be worse. It could be much worse for certain populations. There's just a lot of unknowns, and it is irresponsible for the president to be spreading things that perhaps give people false hope or a false sense of security, because people should be washing their hands, coughing into their elbows, and, you know, I don't know, like not licking poles or whatever.
And we don't want to create panic either, right?
Right.
As you said, there's a lot of things that we simply do not know. And I just want to read some of these numbers so people get a sense of what the partisan divide looked like at least last week. When it came to washing hands more often, 48% of Democrats said they were doing that, 38% of Republicans. Avoiding physical contact, 21% of Democrats, 14% of Republicans. Altered travel plans, 8% of Democrats, 3% of Republicans. And then haven't changed their daily routine, 40% of Democrats, 54% of Republicans. So there are differences, but they're not like vast differences between how Democrats and Republicans
are preparing. Right, and you could see that closing in the next. I mean, we are also only like 10 days into, you know, the announcement from the CDC kind of saying, gird your loins, America, this could be bad. Now we're sort of fully in like wall-to-wall news coverage of this. The markets are obviously taking a plunge. Futures markets aren't doing well. So this also spins into some economic territory.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if those numbers close, to your point. I mean, I'm actually a little surprised at how much there is on Fox News on coronavirus. And I wonder, to Nate's point, if we've reached a level of fear about this and effect, you know, with, as Claire said, the economy and the stock market, where it's just sort of like, okay, we got to go all in on this, our partisan loyalties notwithstanding, you know.
Yeah. So do we rate this a good use of polling or a bad use of polling?
It's good.
Totally good.
It's fine.
It's fine. Yeah. All right.
I think
a weak fine.
The only part I would push back on is the framing that, like, yet another example of how partisan people are, where I don't think the differences are that big, and probably they're at least partly explainable just by demographic and geographic differences.
So before we move on, I do want to talk a little bit about what some of the overall political repercussions of coronavirus could be now that, as you've all mentioned, we are seeing wall-to-wall coverage and it's becoming clear that it's spreading in the United States and not just the result of people returning from vacations, et cetera, et cetera. So how do we see this affecting the Democratic primary?
People could cancel events.
Yeah, Washington votes tomorrow.
Well, all by mail.
By mail. Joe Biden is 77 years old. Bernie Sanders is 78 years old. One of them had a heart attack this summer. They should not be having events shaking hands with lots of people all over the country.
Says 538 Surgeon General.
I said this last week on the podcast. I think it's kind of like only if you are touching that many people, if you are like, it's kind of only a matter of time if you like, just from a I'm not going to say statistical, but like, yes, they are people in their 70s. They're a more vulnerable population.
I think it's
100%.
I think it's, look, we've actually talked about the age of the candidates well before this and how between Biden and Sanders and Trump, you wonder about their health overall, and now especially in the wake of coronavirus, to the point where actually my friends who don't really follow politics as closely, they like started asking about what's going to happen here, you know? So I think it's a totally natural question.
So apart from the age factor, what about the kind of set pieces of the primary, like holding rallies, while campaigning, we've kind of already discussed the national conventions. Are there certain upsides or downsides to one candidate, Bernie Sanders or Biden, when it comes to tackling an epidemiological crisis?
I think it's rallies and stuff aside. I think coronavirus and the way that Trump is handling it right now is almost an advantageous news story for the Democratic candidates. To be blunt about it. Because Trump seems to be spreading misinformation, the administration seems to be back on its heels a little bit. The CDC, which, you know, it could be a Democratic or Republican president, and they could probably have the same underwhelming response and preparedness level. But if government's basic function is public safety and defense, and the U.S. and the Trump administration falls down on that duty in coronavirus, that's automatically an advantage for the Democratic candidates. They can say, this was mismanaged. This was what happens when you don't have a properly run bureaucracy. Oh, and by the way, that economy that he was running on, yikes. Look how unstable his entire platform is. I mean, I just think it feels crass to say, but politics is crass, so deal with it. This is a good story for Democrats.
Yeah. In terms of the Democratic primary, I mean, like you've seen some people say, which is reasonable, you know, maybe people flock a little more towards the quote unquote safe candidate, the candidate with experience in a time of crisis. So that would be maybe this helps Biden marginally. But as Claire was getting at, I think the potential for greater effect is in the general election. Somebody was making this point a few weeks ago of just like Trump has actually gotten pretty lucky for the first few years of his presidency, the extent to which there hasn't been a crisis, right?
Well, North Korea early on, some natural disasters, but there hasn't been like a financial crisis.
There hasn't.
Or a terrorist attack of large proportions.
And North Korea
kind of was his own making.
Yeah, that wasn't.
It was like, an external crisis.
Right.
Like it's like a, God forbid, terrorist attack and like.
Or a health crisis.
Like this is.
Or, you know, whatever.
And frankly, a pandemic.
Yeah.
Is so unpredictable, it leaves all these, like, you know, Northern Italy has shut down, which is a wartime measure. And the idea that an American president would have to potentially grapple with in the coming weeks, should we shut down an American city, essentially? Should we restrict air travel? Like, those are really big decisions that have palpable effects on people's everyday lives and sense of well-being and safety.
I think you did kind of skip over. There is some evidence that's pertinent on the Democratic primary side. The kind of direct evidence is that CNN's poll this morning asked, who do you prefer Biden
national
or Sanders?
Poll.
National poll. Yeah. To handle a national crisis. And Biden, who was doing well in the poll overall, but was still like 40 points ahead on that measure.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's a big gap.
The indirect evidence is that Biden has been rising in the polls to kind of almost ridiculous extents. If you look at some of these state polls, it's almost so large leads now in some of these polls, it's kind of hard to fathom. Obviously, the most likely culprit for that is Super Tuesday, but you also wonder if people are like, you know what? Shit is getting scary. Biden is someone who I trust. Biden helped handle the Ebola response. I want this thing to be over. It's been a long contest. It's going to be Biden. Let's just end this with Biden, right? I just think it kind of, even though you could say, okay, actually, hey, this actually proves a need for like national health insurance. I just don't think that the average voter is necessarily going to process
it.
things that way.
Okay, that's when it comes to the primary. Claire and Mike have been talking about the general a bit and the argument that the Democrats have against the Trump administration now. Do you buy that, Nate?
Yeah, this is not good for Trump. I mean, I think there is a lot of uncertainty about how it'll turn out. One thing that I feel semi-qualified to say is that I think people tend to underestimate both the worst case and the best case scenarios, right? How bad the worst case scenario could be and also how mild the best case scenario could be. I think people, you know, this is exponential growth and you change a little variable, a tiny bit, and you're on a very different trajectory. But clearly, like, you know, I think if you go to prediction markets, which are stupid, they have like a 60% chance, 6-0, of a recession at some point this year. That would seem like a very material problem for Trump. And I don't buy that. Well, people will blame it on coronavirus. It's like, well, I don't know. I mean, we're going to get some national polling soon that'll ask about his handling of it. But like, just the strategy to like have minimized this at the start to try to quell fears in the stock market just seems like, I don't know. I mean, people are so used to like, oh, well, Trump can get away with anything. But again, if you look at the actual elections we've had, he did badly in the midterm. He lost a lot of these special elections, yeah. Right? And if you look at the polls right now, then Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders are ahead of him in the polling average by a large enough margin to overcome what will almost certainly be an electoral college disadvantage again for the Democrats. And so I don't know why there's just like conventional wisdom is still kind of optimistic about Trump's re-election odds. And by the way, this bounce he got in the polls after impeachment, which I think he did get, seems to have worn off. Is that wearing off anyway? Is coronavirus starting to affect the polls? I don't think we know any of that yet.
Yeah. So we're obviously going to talk about this more in the coming weeks because it will last weeks, if not months at this point. So we'll have more time to dig into it. But I do want to talk about the election tomorrow. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by ADT Commercial for Business. It's not politics as usual these days, and it's not business as usual at ADT. ADT Commercial serves businesses ranging from mid-sized organizations to large-scale enterprises. Think of them as national security advisors just for your company. They provide comprehensive security, fire, life safety, and risk management solutions, professional-grade systems for commercial-grade businesses. Voters choose candidates, and businesses choose ADT Commercial. The Fortune 1000 trust ADT Commercial for highly complex, scalable, integrated solutions. And if you're looking for a great partner to upgrade or take over the monitoring and service of your current system, ADT Commercial can help to install and maintain large-scale and multi-site business dependably. Businesses choose ADT Commercial for their complex security solutions. Visit ADT.com/538 to learn more. That's the numbers, not the letters. It's ADT.com/538. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Upstart. Upstart knows that you're more than just your credit score, and they offer smarter interest rates to help you pay off high-interest credit card debt. They go beyond the traditional credit score when assessing your credit worthiness and actually reward you based on your education and job history in the form of a smarter rate. They make it fast, simple, and easy to check your rate. And the best part, once the loan is approved and accepted, most people get their funds the very next business day. Over 400,000 people have used Upstart to pay off credit cards or meet their financial goals. So free yourself from the burden of high interest credit card debt by consolidating everything into one monthly payment with Upstart. See why Upstart is top-ranked in their category with a 4.9 out of 5 rating on Trustpilot, and hurry to upstart.com/politics to find out how low your Upstart rate is. Checking your rate only takes a few minutes, and it's at upstart.com/politics. Again, upstart.com/politics. We're back, and let's take a look at the race nationally before we zoom in on the state's voting on Tuesday. So heading into Super Tuesday, we said that we didn't have enough data to get a clear picture of where the race was between Biden, Sanders, and, well, at that point, even Klobuchar, Warren, and Bloomberg were in the race. Nate, at this point, do we have better data? And if so, what does the race look like nationally?
The polls are a disaster for Bernie and or very good for Biden, depending on which framing you prefer. It's actually the state polls that are bigger issues for Bernie than the national polls. I mean, the two most recent national polls have him down 16 points, which for reference is like a larger lead than Clinton had over Sanders for most of the 2016 primary. The state polls, though, I mean, let me go to our little polling database here. Latest polls. projects.538.com/polls, a place to see all the polls all the time.
Beep, polls, beep, polls, beep, polls. Beep, beep. Live polls.
Okay, so let's look at some polls of Michigan, all out since last night.
We were going to talk about the state of, well.
Well, let me explain why I'm doing this, though, Galen.
that was aggressive.
That was very aggressive.
What was that?
I'm doing this because we have a lot more state polls and national polls. And so you can actually infer things about the state of the race nationally. I'm just going to list every poll, every state poll. This is going to be thrilling podcasting to come out that we've added since yesterday. Michigan, Biden plus 41. Illinois, Biden plus 29. Michigan, Biden plus 30. Florida, Biden plus 28. Michigan, Biden plus 24. Arizona, Biden plus 28. Michigan, Biden plus 21. Mississippi, Biden plus 55. Missouri, Biden plus 30. Okay. That is not a competitive primary. That is not a primary that there's much doubt about the winner. So we're at the point now where, if anything, these national polls might lowball it. Our model, by the way, is pretty conservative with national polls. It says there's no need to rush on national polls. There's no national primary, so it'll be very conservative, where the state polls will get more aggressive.
Are you ready to call the primary over?
No.
This is bullshit, though.
No, the forecast says 95%. 95%. Or whatever, 19 and 20, the forecast says.
Okay, so it's not over.
Yeah.
But let me put it like this.
You are about to let Nate say that it's over. How are you going to put it?
No, I wasn't. That's why I jumped in.
First of all, we have tomorrow. There's no need to prematurely declare anything because, like, you have lots of people voting in the next 8 days, right? Tomorrow, and then 600 delegates roughly go a week from tomorrow. I am more worried that some external factor that's kind of outside the scope of the model, like a candidate getting sick. I'm like almost think that might be the way that the model could be wrong more than like a spectacular.
So like Biden gets coronavirus before voting. Don't you think you could still overcome that?
This is extra model. It's not stuff that we're considering.
Wait, so to nail down on what you just said, apart from any external factor that could come in and really shake things up in an unforeseen way, you think the race is over?
Let me say it precisely. If the polls are right, the polls I just recited are right or even approximately right, then the race is over. If the polls are pretty wrong, the race is still probably over. If the polls are really wrong, then Biden's probably still favored. You know what I mean? I mean, we'll see in the next day. This is why I think there's no need for like, oh, Bernie is toast. Because in 8 days, if he loses Florida by 33 points and Arizona by 12 points and Illinois and Ohio by 13 points, then it is kind of like then it's over, right? Then it's over barring some extreme shock. And so there's no point to get like ahead of it. But like, I think because there's been so much other news, like Biden is way ahead, right? I mean, you know, Washington State, which is supposed to win a Bernie states, is a tie now in the polls. In fact, he's a little bit, our forecast generously, I think, has him half a point ahead. But like, he's actually been a little bit behind in the polls of Washington State.
But maybe the polls are wrong. I mean,
yeah, and they could be wrong in either direction. But like, our model accounts for a lot of uncertainty in polling.
Biden is up so much that maybe they can't be wrong in any direction. Maybe you can only win by so much. But to Nate's point, it's like, it's pretty amazing. After Super Tuesday, you know, we were waiting for results a bit to update the forecast. And if you had asked me, okay, what's it going to show now that Biden had such a great Super Tuesday? Both because Super Tuesday, I think, reflected, Galen, you were talking about kind of, we didn't quite know where the national race was before Super Tuesday. Well, if you use Super Tuesday as just a measure of where it was like, okay, Biden is way out in front here. But also because Super Tuesday then also had the added, could have the added effect of producing a bounce for Biden. I still would have, I was very surprised when our forecast showed, I think at first it showed Biden
90%,
as a 7-8 favorite, I think it was. But this is why it's so good to have a model. It's because, like, why? What was my sense based on, right? Like, not much. And then the polling that has come out since we turned our forecast box back
made
on,
it rise.
If anything,
so
has,
if anything.
You know, so it's like, I don't know. I want to wait for tomorrow and the next couple elections, because who knows? Sanders beat his polls in Michigan in 2016, obviously. But, like, If you base it on the data, this Biden's way out in front, which is pretty surprising.
So, Claire, now that it is a two-person race and it is one where Biden is the clear front runner, what are the contours of the contest between Biden and Sanders? Are we seeing a bunch of attacks now?
Tulsi erasure.
Tulsi erasure.
I'm not even going to respond. What kind of contest are we seeing between Biden and Sanders? What are their campaign strategies, basically?
Well, I think you've seen the Sanders team recognize late in the game with, say, an ad that features Barack Obama prominently, that perhaps it's a good game to play to try to expand your coalition or appeal a little bit more. In Sanders' Tuesday night speech, I believe it was Tuesday night speech, he, you know, really attacked Biden quite forcefully in this way that hadn't really tonally happened on the trail. Like, certainly debates are a different story. But I think it just turns into, like, the Sanders team kind of has to do every last gasp effort. And the Biden team can kind of start running a general election campaign. They made their big play on Super Tuesday via electability, quote unquote. And that's the game that they're going to play for the rest of the however many months we have left in this campaign. I mean, it's not super complicated. Like, I'm kind of curious to see how long Sanders stays in the race. This is kind of assuming that the model is probably right and that Biden will likely clinch the nomination. As we all remember very well, Sanders stayed in the primary until June.
Yeah.
And it's March, and the convention's what, July? I don't know, some middle of July. You do kind of wonder when he would drop out. What, like?
And does the fact that he stayed until June 4 years ago, and we ended up with President Trump, from his point of view, does that change things? I'm not saying those things are connected, but he'll, you know, to your point,
he will face the same difficult choice that every other major candidate who has dropped out has faced, which is, when should I drop out? Should I endorse Joe Biden? When should I do it? Obviously, Klobuchar, Buttigieg, now Harris and Booker this morning all endorsed Biden before the big Super Tuesdays. You know, when would Sanders do something like that is kind of, to me, the big question. And this is me kind of assuming now that the Sanders strategy will be last gasp, we can turn out a bigger coalition, even though that didn't happen on Super Tuesday. So some of their arguments are kind of shot, which kind of makes it difficult.
I do want to talk a little bit about that, because we've seen a lot of analysis turn on turnout numbers, and turnout looks as if it's been high in places where Biden has done well and low in places where Sanders has done well. And there's been particular focus on suburban areas around Northern Virginia, Dallas, Fort Worth, Houston, Orange County, et cetera, having really high turnout and going strongly for Biden. And then some of these more rural areas where Sanders did really well in 2016, not turning out in high numbers. What's the analysis? Why is this happening? Is it simply that young people aren't turning out and that the anti-Trump vote in, like, suburban America, just like in 2018, is really strong? Is that kind of what it is?
I think, I mean, we did some research way back when, that showed that about 20% or 25% of Bernie's vote in 2016 was likely never Hillary voters. People just didn't like Clinton. And they were often people who were in rural areas who were white working class. These people seem to have no objection, at least at present, to Joe Biden. They may not like kind of the more liberal culturally direction that the Bernie campaign has taken, right? And so, like, I mean, this is why, like, people are like, well, Bernie could win Michigan. If you look at the areas that look a lot like Michigan and how they voted so far, they look like Michigan might be an above average state for Biden, actually, right? You have a fairly high African American population. You have very few Hispanics. You have a lot of working class whites. It's not a particularly young state. There are some big universities there that will help Bernie, but, like, you know, it's a different map than you had in 2016. I also think that the speed of this Biden thing has put the Bernie campaign on its heels, right? They have, on the one hand, these arguments about Social Security and Biden's at times implying that he might cut Social Security, which I think is probably one of the better arguments at the stage, right? There's also a lot of chatter about, oh, you know, Biden's mental decline, which is not authorized by the Sanders campaign, but, like, some of, I think, the Sanders stands on Twitter are getting into that territory. There's a lot of...
Do you think that's effective?
I don't think it's the ideal argument when your candidate is half a year older and has his own health issues. I think that's not the argument you would make, right? But also, the Sanders campaign seems to have been never prepared for Biden in a weird way. I go back to this story back in March that their campaign was talking to some Atlantic reporter about, like, our strategy is to basically, I mean, they're very explicit, right? They're like, we want to have the largest, this is not quite how they said it, right? They're like, we want to have the largest faction. And we think if we maintain the largest faction, then the party will get behind us, which is a strategy that looked like pretty smart until a week and a half ago. But nowhere in that article do they mention Biden, except once in passing, right? But not in reference to their strategy. I mean, I think they think, well, we can beat all these other candidates, right? We can beat back Beto and we can beat back Harris and whatever else, right? But there was a consideration of Biden, who, number one, actually does do pretty well with working class voters. Number two, might be a creature of the establishment, but kind of seems folksier than that and doesn't quite have that reputation as much. And, like, so I think they've been put on their heels. But, like, again, it's happened so fast. This is one of the fastest polling movements in American primary history that, like, I don't entirely blame them, but at the same time, like they don't really seem to have a coherent through line against Biden right now.
All right, we've already dug into some of the individual states already, but let's take a closer look at those. And before we do that, today's podcast is brought to you by Hims. It's the kind of news cycle that could make you lose your hair or pull your hair out. And as you may know, there are options now for guys who want to stop their hair from thinning or who want to grow some back. Hims is at the forefront of the telemedicine wave and offers access to a doctor online in all 50 states. No more awkward in-person doctor's visits or long pharmacy lines. Also, the online consultation could save you hours of finding a physician or a dermatologist. Hims licensed doctors have an average of 14 years of experience. Right now, listeners can get started with a free online consultation with a doctor, and if prescribed, get their first month free with a 3-month prescription. Go to forhims.com/538. That's forhims.com/538. Prescription requires an online consultation with a physician who will determine if a prescription is appropriate. Offer valid only if prescribed. 3-month minimum subscription. Additional restrictions apply. See website for full details and important safety information. Remember, that's forhims.com/538. On Tuesday, as I mentioned earlier, the following states will weigh in on the Democratic primary: Michigan, Washington, Missouri, Mississippi, Idaho, and North Dakota. Also, Democrats abroad will finish their voting process. Does this Tuesday have a name, by the way?
Tuesday.
Triple M Tuesday. Michigan, Missouri, and Mississippi.
Okay. Triple M Tuesday.
Washington erasure.
This is Washington erasure.
We've already gotten into this a little bit in terms of Biden has a 99% chance of winning Michigan. And of course, in 2016, Michigan was a big upset.
He also had 99% in our model, kind of infamously.
But Sanders ended up winning. So are we more confident in the data this time around?
Nate should answer this, I guess. But I think of it not so much as, like, there's something about Michigan in particular. I think about what Michigan in 2016 shows is just that once in a while, you do get a big polling miss. And so it's that more general caution that I would urge people to have. Not, you know, maybe there's Nate's from Michigan, so he can speak to that.
So first of all, Biden's lead is actually bigger now than Clinton's was. It's big enough that, like, if polls had been that far off, then Clinton would have narrowly won Michigan. Still a huge polling miss, right? But she would have narrowly won instead of narrowly lost. And there are other things too, like the trajectory is clearly very favorable for Biden here. And I think most importantly, like, your prior is that Biden is ahead at least low double digits nationally, that Michigan is probably at least an average state for him, if not a little bit above average. So it's kind of like, you know, could the polls be way off and Biden only wins by 15 instead of 29? Sure, you know, that's a big polling error. But, like, I don't know, it's almost borders on, like, superstition, right? Like, the question of, like, are polling errors replicated from year to year in the same state is an empirical question, and the answer, I think, is mostly no, with some exceptions. I mean, by the way, because Michigan polling's been so bad, like, all our Michigan pollsters get pretty low ratings, you know what I mean? So that makes the model a little bit more cautious. Something truly shocking in a much greater way than 2016 would have to have happened for Sanders to win Michigan.
So, Claire, Nate mentioned the part of Sanders' coalition in 2016 being an anti-Clinton vote, and maybe Michigan is a good place to look at that because it seemed like Michigan, along with other Midwestern states, were suited to Sanders. What have we learned about Sanders' coalition and perhaps voters' response to Clinton in the 2016 primary as 2020 has played out?
Well, I think it's what Nate said. It's that a lot of people were anti-Clinton voters. I also think that, you know, states like Ohio, Michigan, and Pennsylvania do have, like, among the white populations, have, like, a cultural sensibility that resonates with Biden on some level more than Sanders was the non-elite candidate to Clinton. But Biden kind of, like, fills that out, too. You know, it's the whole, like, Scranton Joe, white Catholic kind of thing that makes people feel like, oh, I kind of know politicians like that in my state. He's a familiar figure. He doesn't feel foreign in a way that, like, I don't know, like a Warren might have to them, because you could stick the, like, Harvard elite thing on. It's hard to compare in some ways the 2016 primary with the 2020 primary because of the anti-Clinton sentiment being so pervasive. The fight between Sanders and Biden is so interesting because in states like Michigan, you know, we talked for a lot of months about how Biden and Sanders voters actually shared certain characteristics. And so I think in states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, whatever, Wisconsin, Ohio, you could see people kind of being like, I like both of them, but all things being equal, Biden has proven to me that he's more quote unquote electable. He had these big wins. Sure, let's go for that. Like, but like, from a cultural sensibility point of view, it's actually interesting that Biden and Sanders are the last men standing.
And yeah, it's the one reason I kind of hope the race goes on a little bit longer. It's like, I think it's so fascinating and will be so fascinating to compare Biden Sanders against Clinton Sanders. Because I do think the hatred for Clinton and the aversion to Clinton, especially revolving around gender and stemming from gender, was a big factor in some of Sanders' support in 2016, and how much of that now goes to Biden.
Well, it's also interesting if you think about 2008 to 2016 to 2020, because in 2008, Hillary Clinton was doing really well in Western Pennsylvania and those kinds of areas of the country that ended up 8 years later being really good areas for Sanders and not good areas for Clinton. Now, 4 years after that, you have these areas that were really good for Sanders being better for Biden. It just kind of, like, politics is all relative in a way.
Yes. Totally.
Yeah, Biden's kind of getting the Clinton 08 map, but with black and Hispanic voters reversed from 08.
Well, but Hispanic voters are where Hispanic voters are at, I think, is an interesting question.
Yeah, one of the states that we thought our model thought might be good for Bernie was Arizona. He clearly has done well in Nevada and California.
Yeah.
And did tolerably well in Texas, although lost it. But Arizona has a lot of old people. And it's kind of has a culture of conservatism politically. And Bernie was way down in that Arizona poll we finally saw, one of the first recent Arizona polls that we've had. Look, the fact is that like Bernie's constituency just isn't very big right now. And so kind of no matter how you slice and dice it, then it's going to look kind of bad. And the one place that seemed like it was pretty perfect for Bernie's 2016 constituency is California, which has now voted. And so, you know, there's no more gains to be had from there. In fact, our friend of the pod, Nate Cohn at the New York Times Upshot blog, a blog, the like 538.
Let me just explain that. The joke there, people, is that a lot of
people write us letters.
Mainstream media people, when they want to like throw a little shade at 538, they'll call it a blog.
Or Micah Cohn, a writer at Nate Silver's blog.
Right, exactly. Yes, yeah.
So the Upshot, our co-blog at the New York Times. He estimated that to get their Super Tuesday results you had, it was equivalent to Biden being ahead by 20 points nationally.
Seems about right.
Which means that, because the raw vote count wasn't 20 points, it means that like that was actually a pretty good set of states for Bernie, largely because of California has so many votes.
And perhaps Texas. Early voting as well.
Yeah, I don't know if he was kind of for early voting or not, right? But if that's the case, then like, you know, then it's just not that close. And we're so used to primaries that are competitive and general elections that are competitive. And this primary was competitive as of like two weeks ago.
Yeah.
That, you know, landslides look really impressive. And currently the polling shows a potential landslide for Biden. We'll see if that holds up in reality.
So the one state that looks good for Sanders on Tuesday is Washington. I think he still has a 51% chance of winning there. What about Washington, given that we've painted such a kind of dire picture for the Sanders camp? Why is he still favored, not really favored, but a even shot to win Washington?
It's Western, it's white, and a lot of people voted early,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Good summation.
Let's set a benchmark of what a good night for Bernie would be. And like, let's not base it strictly on the forecast. Let's sort of like, you know.
Okay, but before we do that, let me just tell people where the forecast is and then paint me a picture of what would be a good night for Sanders. So Washington, 50% chance for Sanders. Missouri, 93% chance for Biden. Mississippi, 99% chance for Biden. Idaho, 58% chance for Biden. And finally, North Dakota is a 65% chance for Biden. And Democrats Abroad, sorry, is...
I guess it's all those Westerns.
I think we're lowballing Bernie Democrats Abroad.
Yeah.
I want that on the record.
Our model isn't...
It has Democrats Abroad 50-50. I think I lean Bernie there.
Our model isn't good at the territories or the...
Yeah,
I guess a good night for Bernie looks like him winning the Western states, basically, right?
Well, Idaho and Washington.
So that's the question is... Are we now at a point where we would call it a good night for Bernie even if he doesn't win Michigan?
No. In fact, the problem is the reverse, that like if Bernie wins Michigan by a point, he's still going to lose delegates on the evening probably, because it means he's going to lose Missouri by 15, Mississippi by 38, right? Kind of break even elsewhere, maybe gain a few points in Washington, a few delegates.
So yes, I totally agree with that. But this is why I didn't want to base it solely off the forecast. Is like if Bernie won Michigan by a point and then won North Dakota, Idaho, and then Biden cleans up in Missouri, Mississippi, I think we would...
Call it a comeback.
No, I think we would say what Nate just said, which is like this is still a world where Sanders is in trouble. But I think the media would call it a comeback.
Yeah.
And so that's a weird world because... Are we at a point now in the race where the media narrative doesn't matter and it's just about delegates and who gives a shit if the media calls it a comeback and produces a bounce? Or does it still matter if there is a narrative shift and you get what I mean?
I mean, is it still a point in the race where mathematically things, if they turned around in this election tomorrow, where it would matter? Yeah, I think. Right?
I think
that's
so.
Why it's a 95% chance and not 100% chance.
I think that's right, yeah.
Well, but the thing is also like at this point, it would be such a polling screw-up if Biden were to lose Michigan. Then you have to wonder, are these polls any good anymore? But it would be pretty strange.
All right. So I think we can leave things there for now. We got through a lot today. And as we've been recording, the Dow has continued to drop.
In the quarantine, people have lots of time to listen to podcasts. We're going to be doubling the length of our podcast for the...
How are we going to record it?
Yeah, the quality of our podcast might go down if we're all
quality goes
remotely.
Down, volume goes up.
Isn't that how it all works? All right, anyway, let's leave it there. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, Micah.
Thank you.
And also a reminder to check out our live blog tomorrow night. We will be live blogging the results as they come in from all of those states. You can ask us questions and we will podcast when it's all over. Until then, my name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening and we'll see you soon.